This is an ABC podcast.
Christina Olsen grew up in a loving family. If you were to look at her family portrait that was taken in Brisbane back in the 1960s, this is what you'd see. You'd see little Christina with her big sister Sharon and their brothers Ashley and Andrew. And holding them close are Chris's parents, her darkly beautiful mum, Yvonne, and her Scandinavian dad, Arnie. Looking at that picture decades later, Christina sees another brother, an older brother, who was always there, in the shadows, right behind her mum. His name is Peter. And Peter was taken from Chris's mother when he was just 18 months old. He was literally snatched from her arms. But all Christina knew when she was growing up was that her mum had lost a baby boy, and not to ask any questions about him. Well, Chris's mum died a few years ago now, and for 5 years Chris asked all those taboo questions, and she unravelled the story of her family. I spoke to Chris Olsen in 2014 after she published her book, Boy Lost, a family memoir. Hello, Christina.
Hello, Richard.
What do you remember of how your mum was when you were little?
She was a wonderful mother. We all absolutely adored her, but she was undoubtedly sad. There was a sadness about her that we could never pinpoint, if you like. There was no conscious knowledge in our heads about the missing child. We didn't know about that consciously until later, but I know that there was certainly an unconscious knowledge of this child-shaped grief, if you like, in the house and around her. So while she was wonderful and warm, she was also a little bit removed, and we weren't quite sure why.
What would happen if you were to upset her the way we do when we're kids?
Our mother had a particular way of expressing her sadness or displeasure or disappointment with us, which we later would call the cold winds of Siberia. And my sister, if she's listening, will know exactly what I'm talking about. She was in the way of it lots of times, probably more than me. I think, as it turns out, the middle child, I think I spent a lot of time trying to be good.
You were the Jan Brady of the family?
Jan Brady, absolutely. The barometer of everyone's feelings, I think. But Sharon and I, up to a point, would be to remove herself even further and not speak, be absent even more than, you know, we were aware that she was. It was the worst punishment we could have because, of course, we spent all our lives trying to pull her closer, to have her removed even more and to ignore us because she was disappointed with us was the worst thing. We would all absolutely then scurry to try to make up for whatever imperceptible wrong we'd done.
What did you really know? You just said you had the faintest idea that there was something missing there. What did you know was the... What did you suspect or know was the cause of this sorrow that hung around your mum?
We knew there was something that had happened before she met our father. That was all. It was such a tightly kept secret that we really didn't know, and we knew we couldn't ask questions about it. If anything came up about her former life, she would very quickly change the subject. A dark cloud would almost literally come over her face. So I think what we did was we picked up little hints, phrases, things overheard from aunts, perhaps even my sister, because of course Sharon did know. Up to a point, she didn't know everything, but because she was also the child, she was Peter's full sister, if you like. Although we've never seen it that way. As far as I'm concerned, she's my sister. There's no other word for who she is. But she knew little bits more than that. So perhaps I might have, or my brothers might have overheard her say something to someone.
Did you talk about it as kids? Did you go, the reason why? Did you know there was a previous marriage?
No, I couldn't say that we knew. I can only say that we suspected, perhaps. From things like, I guess, I remember once saying to mum, as children do, where did you go for your honeymoon, mum? What did you and dad do? And there were two answers to that question. One was Sydney and one was Cairns. That's all I can remember, Richard. I can't remember, what circumstances the question was asked in, but I remember very much going, why is she confused about where our honeymoon was?
You know, reading about this made me realise that, you know, when we're kids and we talk to our parents about the sadnesses they've inevitably counted in the lives that they had before we were born, those things look so big to us when we're kids, don't they? The way, enormous. You know, the way school buildings look much bigger when we're little too.
Yes, they become, I suppose, larger than life in our imaginations, perhaps. And in a way, I guess maybe that helped me write this story, the fact that I still had some of those larger than life feelings and memories about the story.
The thing is, though, your mum's sorrow was a big thing. It was a very, very big thing.
Mm.
We have to go back to her story now. When she was growing up, what name did your mum's family know her by?
When I was growing up, she was known variously as either Yvonne or Vonnie or Mimi.
Mimi.
Mimi, yes. And that continued for most of her life. It was her second name. Her middle name was Minnie, and I think it was appropriated from that. It became the name that her grandchildren still do refer to her by.
Can you describe what she looked like when she was a young woman?
Oh, devastatingly beautiful, devastatingly. People even now will recall her as looking like a young Elizabeth Taylor. So that kind of look, that chiselled face, the very dark hair pulled back, slightly gypsy look about her, slightly wicked look about her eyes.
What kind of home was she raised in?
Oh, interesting home, I think. I've only just really, got to the bottom, or as close to the bottom as you can with that kind of thing. But a mother who was very working class, I still remember being embarrassed by my grandmother in public at times. Her vowels were so loud in public. She she was a gambler. She loved to bet on a chocolate wheel or the date of a baby's birth, you name it. She'd have a shilling
like
on it.
Drink and smoke and swear, did she?
Oh, she loved a party. Just loved a party. Didn't care for education, though. And my poor mother, intelligent, clever, ambitious, was pulled out of school at 12 to help with twins who arrived at that time in that family. Her father, though, was an Englishman who valued education and culture very highly. Introduced her, I think, to opera by the wireless, as it was in those days. She adored opera. I couldn't ever figure out for a long time how it was that a working class girl like her would adore opera. It seemed not to go, but that's where it came from.
From the ABC, as
yes.
It probably was in those days.
Mm.
How did she meet Michael, the man who she would marry?
She met him in what was then called the Palms Cafe in Queen Street. It was one of those beautiful arcaded and boothed cafes, carpet on the floor, photos of palm trees at the back. I can just imagine it in the 50s and the 60s, people coming to town to have their tea. It wasn't really coffee then, although there was coffee about, but people would come to have tea and scones in those cafes if you had the dollars or the pounds to do so. He was a regular. He was just arrived from Greece and would meet a couple of his friends there in the cafe. She met him on the third or fourth time, I think, that he visited.
Was she working there?
She was a waitress.
She was a waitress there.
Yes.
Okay. How do you imagine her?
I imagine her as this beautiful, she was a teenager. You know, this is something I have to keep reminding myself about. She was 16 when she met him. I remember myself at 16, and I try to make the comparison. A bit flirty, a bit pleased with how she looked, I think, although she would never have said that. Her father would never have liked her to think, that she thought she was beautiful. But she had a very nipped-in waistline, gorgeous legs, always did, all her life, beautiful ankles. So I think she knew how lovely she was, and because of the home she'd come from, because she had been deprived, I guess, of that education and some of the potential that she had, I think she was looking around for ways to escape it and ways to get, to fulfil that potential, perhaps.
So then this young Greek migrant, or youngish Greek migrant.
No, twice her age.
Twice her age.
Mm.
How old was he?
He was 32, 33 when they met.
And how good looking was he?
Devastating as well. So it was kind of, this collision of physical attributes as well as culture. He was a very good looking man. Interestingly, I always had seen him as big and muscly, given what eventuated. I always saw him as sort of thuggishly big, but as it was, he was little. He was perhaps even shorter than she was, but very, very good looking. Again, dark, very worldly man. Very, very much in charge of himself and his body and what was going on around him.
And he wooed her.
Absolutely, courted her. I think she found him irresistible, and his words and his way of speaking exotic. again, otherworldly. She saw her chance of getting that other world.
So I know it's creepy to talk about your mum this way, but there was clearly a powerful sexual attraction.
Oh, absolutely. My aunts still talk about it. They say that she was completely besotted by him.
What did the family, though, think of Michael, her suitor?
Well, I know my grandfather was very disapproving. My great-grandmother, my mother's own grandmother, very disapproving.
Was that a Greek thing, or was it a race thing, or was it more just because they thought he was a bit of a charming Charlie with
exactly.
no
Exactly. They
no
said
prospects.
He was silver-tongued, and right. he was twice her age, so I think they worried that, you know, they were concerned about the relationship and the way he spoke. He was just very, very knowing, and she was a very naive girl from the outskirts of Brisbane. She had very little experience of relationships. She'd had, I think, one suitor before that.
How did the relationship then between Michael and your mother then go to the next step?
Michael was ambitious as well. He wanted to open fish and chip shops. There's a fine tradition of course, Greek people doing that, and they're still about. He wanted a piece of that, and there was a Greek grapevine, if you like, of opportunities. There was one in Cairns. He invited her for a little holiday. Her parents were rather aghast at this, but she was pretty determined to go.
This is the late 40s, isn't it? So this was quite scandalous behaviour, I suppose.
Quite scandalous behaviour. But she was, as I said, besotted with this man, and I think saw an opportunity to get out of a very beige kind of Brisbane.
Yeah, back in the late 40s, yeah. So then she goes up to Cairns with this dashing young Greek suitor. Mm. And what happens then?
The inevitable happens. She falls pregnant and decides to stay. She decides to stay because he... For some reason, I can't see why, looking back, sticks by her.
How old was she?
She was 18.
18 years old.
Mm.
How did she break that to her family, I wonder?
Well, I think it was very difficult for her to break it to her father. She adored her dad and adored everything he stood for, that upright Englishness, the cultural values that he stood for. So I think that hurt her deeply to have to say that. But I think by then she'd developed a thick skin. And
it's my life.
Exactly. And I'll make the decision about it. And so she went back to Cairns and moved in with Michael in the fish and chip shop that he had.
And they got married?
Took them a long time. It took till the September. Peter was born in the December. So it took them quite a few months. And as far as I know, she was having to nag, if you like, for this to happen.
What kind of life was there for her in Cairns?
Mostly terrible. I think there were, some lighter moments. She saw very quickly that he was an addicted gambler. He was away at the tables many nights a week, and then sometimes for days at a time. If he won, he would come home and would quite often spin around dancing with a violin. He was a very good dancer in the Greek way and quite a gifted musician, as I understand. But if he lost, then she would feel his hand and his feet, terrible, terrible bruising. Abuse very early on. There was also her daily life in the fish and chip shops, where she worked in what I can only think now as slave-like conditions. Even pregnant, she was down on all fours, packing fridges, flipping hamburgers, working very long hours during the day, and then, of course, having to wait at home, wondering what would happen at night.
And then their first child, Peter, your older brother, was born. Did Michael, her husband, change after Peter was born?
I think there was a small honeymoon period, if you like. A firstborn boy in lots of cultures, but certainly in the Greek culture, is a very important thing. He was, by all intents, a beautiful baby. The photos I've seen of him, gorgeous, dark-haired boy. He looked a lot like his father. But I think the reprieve was brief and the violence began again.
How isolated was your mum then in Cairns?
Utterly. Utterly isolated.
Any friends at all?
No, none. There was a woman who lived in the flat next door. We know that she spoke to her occasionally, but not very often. And I think what happened there, Richard, was that the violence had already diminished her. The violence had already had this terrible effect of somehow inculcating a shame and guilt in her, that somehow it was all her fault. This is a fairly common thing, I think, among women who are beaten so badly that they see that they must be bad in some way and must in some way deserve this.
Is it because she made that choice in spite of her parents' misgivings?
That was partly it. I think she'd taken such a big risk that she certainly didn't want to admit it, and she certainly didn't want to tell her family what was happening, or anyone else. Who would want to admit that you've been beaten to within an inch of your life every day? Not many.
Then one day she turned up back at the family home in Brisbane. Why? Why did she go back? What had happened?
There'd been some terrible violence. One instance in which she was again pregnant and he threw her down a set of stairs and then tossed a cupboard down after her. She miscarried that baby. No one in Brisbane knew, but the woman next door finally took some action and sent my grandparents a very brief note, something to the effect of, get her out of here before he kills her. My grandparents didn't have the wherewithal, but my mother's own grandmother did, and sent her a train ticket in the mail with, again, another very short, very elegant note, I think, just to say, get out, come home, love Gran. So she did. She tried. It must have taken an enormous amount of courage, I think, for her to one morning collect her very meagre belongings and Peter, he was by then just over 12 months old, and go to the train station and get on the train.
She was pregnant at that stage too.
She was pregnant again with my sister.
Did Michael know she was pregnant?
No. By now she'd known to keep that information to herself. I think it was one of the first self-protective things she did with him. I think she realised that somehow a pregnancy incited more violence in a way, but certainly she was very protective of this new pregnancy. Well, it wasn't even actually new by then. It was about 6 months. Not that you'd be able to see, because she was so thin with malnutrition, because he would starve her as well. Her body was already in trouble. Her kidneys were suffering. He would do things like go away to Innisfail, to where the gambling tables were very rich, and leave her with nothing, no food, no money. And this happened repeatedly. So she was, by the time she got to Brisbane, suffering from severe malnutrition, had to be hospitalised immediately.
Clearly he thought a lot of his problems would be solved if she just died then.
Absolutely. And I think that's what he told people later, that she had died. That's what he told Peter.
So then your mother, Yvonne, takes this bid for freedom. She takes her meagre belongings and your older brother, Peter, to the train station in a bid for freedom there. What happened then?
I think she cowered in that carriage, terrified that he would find her.
At the station.
She was already on the train, in the train carriage. Cairns was a different place then. I think we've got to remember what a different place Australia was entirely. And Cairns was a little frontier town, small, very easy to find people, but dirt road still, horses still in the main road. And he did, in fact, find her. He boarded the train, took is not the right word. I can't think of the right verb, actually, Richard, but he pulled Peter savagely from her arms, told her he was taking him, she had to stay on the train or they'd both be dead. She knew that he meant it. She'd already suffered so badly. So as soon as the train began to pull out, he waited until then, cruelly, and then got off the train. I've learnt since that there were probably a few big, burly cane cutters standing on the station that he'd brought with him in case there was more resistance than he expected. So she sat on the train. Without her son.
And left Cairns.
The
train pulled out.
Well, it was a long train ride then too to Brisbane. I can't imagine that journey for her. These days it's 2 full days, but in those days I think it was 4. Those 4 days must have been like a hell on earth, I imagine.
Did she ever talk to you about that train
ride? Never. Never. And, you know, I guess years ago I would have said I was frustrated by that and frustrated by the silence. But looking back now, and as a mother and a grandmother now, I think, why would you want to talk about it? Why would you want to relive it by speaking the words that would make it real again? I can absolutely understand why she didn't.
I think we can all know what she was thinking and feeling.
Mm. Yes.
What condition was she then when she arrived into Brisbane, where her family was?
When she arrived, they were waiting for her at the station. I don't know how that happened, but they were waiting for her at the station. My aunts remember her coming off the train. All they remember is thinness. She was so fine and so thin. They couldn't tell she was 6 months pregnant. She just looked incredibly depleted and was taken straight to hospital.
Did she tell people what had happened? Did she then try and in a kind of panic try to get Peter back?
I think that came later. To start with, it was about saving her life and the life of the new baby. Her kidneys were failing. She was admitted to hospital and kept there. I think that must have been another very cruel waiting time where I imagine she must have had to have weighed up the life of the new baby inside her with the baby she'd just lost, because staying in hospital to keep this new baby alive meant days without being able to try to get that other baby back. Another cruel set of circumstances. But that baby was born, my sister was born, and I think almost immediately she began to try to find Peter.
So your sister was born, Sharon, and how was she with Sharon once your older sister was born? How was Yvonne with her?
She was very protective, barely let her out of her sight. But of course, in the way of the world then, especially for women, she had to find a living to make. She was living back with her parents. There were six other siblings in the house, a disabled father, very working class family. She had to go and make a living and pay her way. So Sharon had to be looked after. So it was difficult. She was trying to hold on to this child very hard, but she also had to leave her to go to work.
How did she then try and get Peter back?
She went to what was then, I suppose, the equivalent to legal aid, the public trustee, went a couple of times and told the story. I imagine her sitting there. It must have been an extraordinarily difficult story to tell, because I think by then she was already feeling ashamed for something for which she was utterly blameless. She felt an enormous amount of guilt and shame about it all her life.
There is something crazy in people too. I don't know what this is, but it happens in men and women. There's this tendency to blame the battered woman. I don't know where that comes from, but I've seen it happen again and again. I don't know what that's about and what that says about us as people, but there's a tendency to look down upon a battered woman. Well, how could you have let that happen to you? Or you must have done something to instigate the violence.
I think partly it's our own fear. I think it's partly our own fear and our own knowledge of what we're capable of ourselves, and we don't like to go too close to that.
How was her attitude to men changed by what had happened?
She said to me when I was a teenager that she'd hated men for a few years of her life, and told us a story then without context. I didn't know, as I said, about what had happened previously, but she told me stories about how much she hated men and about one particular instance which symbolised this hatred. She was still very beautiful, a very beautiful woman, and she would be asked out by young men on dates. She would turn them down regularly. Of course, there was Sharon to rush home to. But after a while, I think she started to see that the beauty that had actually failed her, in a way, she could use to her own uses, I suppose. So there was a time, she told me, where she was asked out by three different fellows for the same night, a Friday night. She said yes to them all, one by one, and told each of them that she'd meet them on the corner of Queen and George Street, but on a different corner. Each one was told a different corner to stand on. On the night, she turned up and hid behind a pillar on the fourth corner and just stayed there watching. Watched as they turned up, watched as they waited, watched as they checked their watches, dusted themselves down, adjusted their cufflinks, tidied their tie. And as it got to an hour, more than an hour, without her being there, they each one by one wandered off. And she went home feeling very good about it, very good about herself and her own power. Again, I can understand that. This is a woman who'd had no power over the worst thing happening to her, and suddenly here was a little bit of power that she could get back.
It's a strange kind of revenge.
It's a strange kind of revenge, but it must have been very sweet at the time.
Those guys, though.
I love the story.
No idea.
I mean, I know it's a bit cruel of me to like it so much, but I think I'm barracking for my mother here and seeing, you know, just a little bit of joy, even if it was a little bit, you know, misled.
Meanwhile, Christina, was she writing to Michael about getting her son back?
She did begin to write to Michael, but then would screw those letters up, of course, because he was illiterate. She kept going back to the public trustee. She tried to contact, he had a sister in Sydney. Nothing came back. And, of course, the public trustee's advice to her was to leave it alone, that if his father had gone to so much trouble to have this child, then this child would have a wonderful life. And what kind of life could she give him? Single mother, very, very low wage, nothing. Let him go. He also said to her, or one of the people she saw at the public trustees said to her, oh yeah, we could probably get him back, you know, but he'll spend the next 10 years of his life being pinched out of backyards. Is that the kind of life you want for this child? You know, we'll get him, they'll get him, we'll get him, they'll get him. And I realised later, after all the research I'd done, that of course when women had their babies forcibly adopted, that was what was said to them as well. What kind of life do you want for your kid?
So 4 years after she's left Cairns then and had to leave her son behind, or had her son taken from her, I should say, she met another man who was your father,
yes.
Arnie. How did she meet him?
Quite by accident. She had to deliver a message to a friend, happened to be where my father was also living. He'd been recently arrived from Sweden. She sat on the steps waiting for her friend to come home. He went up the steps to make coffee, offered her a cup of coffee. She said, no thanks, waiting for a friend. He said, well, your friend's gone out. I saw her go out. She still said, no thanks. And off she went. Later, she would tell us that what drew her immediately to him was his disregard, really. He wasn't completely in awe of her to start with, which, of course, she was a bit used to.
So that's how she knew he would be the right man, in a funny way.
Yes, in a funny kind of way. But I think it came together later as he gave her a lift home one evening from her friend's house. And in that very short time, I think they discovered things about each other that enabled a very fledgling trust to develop. I've got a very good friend who says that the first 15 minutes with anyone are the most important. And I think it was absolutely true of these two. Sometime after that, he invited her to a movie. And sometime after that, in the little flat that he had, she saw a photo of a little boy on his wall.
On ABC Radio, you're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
Who was that boy?
Well, as it turns out, he had also lost a child. He'd left behind a child from a marriage in Sweden. Not quite as dramatically as my mother's loss. He was still in touch with Lennart. But I think their relationship then began to grow around this trust of each other that must have come from finally meeting someone who has lost and suffered as much as you have.
And who could accept that.
Absolutely. Yeah. They both validated each other, I think.
What kind of a pact then did they make between the two of them?
An extraordinary pact. Even thinking about it now, it takes my breath away. Because they both have what they would have called previous lives, when they decided to marry, they sat down together and made each other a promise. They could ask each other in this conversation anything they wanted to ask, and the other would reply as fully as they possibly could. So they would open up everything, empty out all the drawers, put it all out into the air, and then close it and never speak of it again.
Never speak of it again?
No, never speak of it again. So the past was the past. And I think this was the place we lived in. I think this wasn't such a unique conversation to have. People needed to get on with the future, and that's what they did.
So then you were born as the daughter of Arnie and Yvonne.
Yes.
And you grew up in this not knowing. So this is the sorrow that your mother carried with her.
The
very big sorrow and the real sorrow. What do you think you absorbed then from that sorrow by osmosis, you personally, Christina?
A great deal, you know, Richard, and I didn't know this until I began to write the book. I think certainly a sense of not being fully entitled to your dreams and the world, that you had to be very careful with what you did with your ambition and your dreams. Certainly risk wasn't encouraged. But the biggest thing I think that I came out of it with was about children, that you held on very tight to children. There was, you know, clearly never going to be another lost child. And of course, I had children myself, and that's what I did too. I held onto them way too tight, I think, as it turned out. I can see that now. But it was very much, I think, in our blood. I've watched my sister and my brothers do it as well.
How did contact between your lost brother and your mother, how was that re-established?
Very dramatically, as it had been lost. In the lead-up to it, though, Peter had tried very hard in a very chaotic way to find his mother. He always knew, despite what his father said, that his mother was alive. He just knew it in his blood. I think he had a muscle memory of her holding him. So he'd done things like just run away and asking people in the street if they'd seen his mother. He'd knock on, as he got older, he'd knock on the doors of police stations and say, "I'm looking for a woman with this name. I think it's this name," or something like it. He knew that his father had been in Cairns where he'd been married, so he'd find himself in Cairns, walking up and down the streets looking for a face or a set of eyes like his. It wasn't until he married himself and his wife said to him, "Haven't you ever heard of births, deaths and marriages, Peter?" So one day they found themselves in the births, deaths and marriages in Brisbane, and they had my mother's maiden name. That's all they had. And they had a set of initials, which were my grandparents' initials. And it was his wife, I think, who found the matching set for my grandparents. Peter then looked at the electoral roll and found an address, and off they went to my grandparents' place.
On that day?
On that day.
On the same day?
On the same day.
So they showed up completely unannounced?
Completely unannounced.
What happened?
Well, true to form, my grandmother, who was forever irascible, opened the door. Peter said to her, told her who he was, told her who he was looking for, and she said, "Oh, you're Mick's son. She won't want to see you." Quite extraordinary. Peter, thankfully, held himself together and said, "Well, perhaps not, but I'd like the address." She looked at him quizzically and then said, "Wait here." Didn't invite him in, left him on the porch. And she came back with a handwritten note with the address. And then he had the address.
So then he arrived at your house?
Yes, yes. It wasn't my house then. I was married and had children by then, but it was my
parents'
house, and one of my brothers was still living at home.
When he knocked on the door, who answered the door?
Well, my mother answered the door. He had actually watched her come up the road and knew, of course, as soon as she turned in the gate, who it was, that was his mother. So I think he waited and for a minute and got himself together and then knocked on the door.
How did Peter describe that meeting his mother later, afterwards?
He said at the time that everything fell into place for him as soon as he looked at her. And that's what I mean about muscle memory. I think there must have been something in him because they just moved towards each other, as I understand it. He said everything. He said there was always a question for him. There was always a question, and as soon as he saw her, he knew she was the answer.
Did she hold him?
Yes.
So then you eventually found out what had happened to Peter.
Yes.
All these years he'd been gone.
Shocking.
All these years. After he'd been taken by Michael, your mum's first husband, how had Michael cared for Peter after he'd snatched him from that railway station?
Cared is a euphemism, Richard, for what happened to Peter with his father. His father abused Peter in the same way as he'd abused Peter's mother, my mother. I think Michael might have tried in an offhand way to begin with, but Michael didn't have the wherewithal either, and so the punishments went to Peter instead of to my mother. So Peter was beaten, was punished, was put to work in shops. He began running away from home looking for his mother at 6.
What had Michael told him about his mother?
2 things, either that she was dead or that she'd run away from him, didn't want him, didn't care about him, and had run away with a German. Probably the worst thing you could say about a woman post-World War II.
How did Peter then contract polio?
Michael took him back to Sydney after taking him from my mother and then went in search of more fish and chip shops. He went into regional New South Wales. I think his first shop was in Junee, where he put Peter into the care of various people in the town. It was in one of those houses, in the backyard of one of those houses, where Peter one day fell and basically didn't get up. So he was 2, 2 and a half.
Where was he taken to have his polio treated?
He was taken immediately to Wagga Wagga Hospital and put in isolation. He was in isolation for some time. Even after he came out of isolation, though, his father didn't come. So his father basically abandoned him emotionally then. He saw him sporadically after that. He had one visitor who was his father's sister, Adriana, who he still remembers very, very fondly because I suppose she was the mother figure or the only figure of warmth and compassion in his life.
And he had to learn to walk again.
Very, very painfully. He had contracted the worst form of the disease, which is paralytic polio. He lost the use of one leg, very, very slowly got it back. So it affected his right leg and the left side of his upper body. So he had to learn to walk again and to hold himself again. But I think while he relearned that, he lost very, very significantly his trust, his ability to love even, because there was nothing around him that showed him how to do that.
Then his father, Michael, vanished for a while, went to Greece and came back with a new wife called Sophia. How did Michael treat this new wife? Any different from Yvonne?
No. I think there was a brief honeymoon period and then the punishments went to her as well. He was still gambling at the stage more and more. Again, home with a loss. If Sophia spoke, she would see the hard end of his hand and then would take that out on Peter. I suppose it's a real paradigm of power, isn't it, Richard, where the most powerful and the least powerful. So Michael would beat her and she would look around for the person, you know, less vulnerable than her, and that was Peter.
What did she call Peter?
She called him a crip, a little wog, and a boutana, which in Greek means...
prostitute.
Yes.
Yeah, whore.
Yeah. Yes, a child of a prostitute.
So that's why he started running away as best as he could, I suppose, with the... Yes. The legs that he had.
Yes.
Under the circumstances.
Yes.
So, looking for his mother.
Looking for his mother.
Peter was never given any reason to believe that his mother wanted him. So why do you think he believed that she still did want him?
I think he needed to believe it, Richard. I think in children, this survives against all the odds, this need to believe, and he did. Later on, he found evidence of that. He found some paperwork in the garage, which indicated that my mother's name and that he had a sister. This galvanised him, of course, to look.
So in running away, how far away from home did he get?
Spectacularly, the first time was when he was 6, and he got from regional New South Wales all the way to central Sydney.
My God!
I know, a little boy with a caliper on his leg, lurching along, got all the way to Central Station, bundled himself off the train and began to accost women walking by, asking them whether they'd seen his mother.
There's this weird moment that was some years later, I don't know, when Peter and Yvonne might have met. Can you tell me about that?
My mother and my father had gone to Sydney on honeymoon. My father wanted to go to Sydney to see some friends on some Swedish ships. They were at Central Station. We're almost certain that my mother saw a little boy with a limp, that's how she described it, in the distance, and it was at exactly the same time as Peter had run away.
And why did she think it might be Peter?
I don't know why she thought. It must have been a look, a glance, or perhaps just that wish, that need for... Because, of course, she'd spend all her life looking. She couldn't walk down a street without looking at children's faces. She didn't know where he was, so she looked everywhere.
But would the calipers he was wearing have thrown her off to some degree? Because she thought, that wouldn't be my boy.
It didn't throw her off. I don't know what that's about. I have no idea. It's one of those mysteries that I'll never know. But it didn't throw her off, and she looked at this boy. There must have been something about the shape of his head or his eyes that made her heart lurch.
At some point, Peter was sent to boys' homes to sort of grow up there. How did that go for him?
Terribly, as it did for so many boys and still does for so many children. He was abused there as well, suffered terribly, and of course Michael didn't visit him there either. He, I think, really developed this way of being in the world then, which was entirely self-protective, on guard against everything. He then, you know, moved between home and children's homes and the street, because he felt safer on the street than he did at home.
What changed for him eventually? How was his life able to take a turn for the better?
A little bit like my mother's. It was a job, I think. Yeah. A job we underestimate, I think, a lot when we think about unemployment and what employment means. But these jobs meant everything. They meant self-esteem. They meant the wherewithal to eat again. And he got a job. He got a bit of training. And he met a pastor at St. Barnabas Church in Sydney, who set him to work using the limbs he could use, which were his arms and hands, painting a church fence. He then got a series of jobs after that. was driving a taxi for some time when he met a man who was ostensibly doing up some houses, which turned out to be what became a very famous brothel in Sydney. And Peter became the handyman at the brothel, which he looks back on with great fondness. He had a great time.
Someone's got to fix those places up, don't
Indeed.
They?
Indeed.
Did he have anyone on his side this time? I mean, you mentioned there his ex-wife, Kim. It sounds like she was able to give him a bit of perspective on what he needed to do in bridging that gap between him and his mother.
Kim certainly set him on a road that ended up with that that reunion with Mum, and absolutely backed him. I think Kim identified in Peter what was missing and was able to encourage, after the reunion, you know, him to try really hard to make it work. They had a daughter, of course, who became the centre of, and still is, the centre of Peter's life.
So then, eventually, as an adult, contact between Peter and your mum, your joint mother, is the word I'm looking for? I don't know,
yes.
Mutual mother,
yes.
is re-established.
Yes.
Once that had been done, did Yvonne try and become a regular part of his life once they reconnected?
Yes, absolutely. I think she was very afraid. I think she was really worried about the sorts of things Peter had grown up hearing. And despite Peter's protestations that he'd never felt abandoned, I think she knew somewhere inside him, he did feel abandoned.
Could he tell her the truth of what he'd been through as a child?
Not entirely. I don't think he told himself. He didn't allow himself to know the truth. Not until I was writing this book and we had many conversations. And in fact, it was right towards the end of me writing the book, that Peter was able to come to terms with some of the terrible things that had happened to him. So no, I think he tried to protect her from some of that stuff as he was protecting himself.
I don't suppose there could ever be, you know, happily ever after in the story like this. There's just too many.
No.
Too much.
Too many variables. Too much damage, collateral damage and real damage, physically, emotionally, mentally. I think with perhaps good counselling, they might have had a chance. But I think the thing is, they were never going to get back what they'd lost. She was never going to get that baby back.
Never.
He was never going to get that young, beautiful mother back. They both were confronted with older versions of what they'd lost, and there must have been terrible confrontations for them both emotionally in that.
Was he with your mum when she died?
No. They had a series of estrangements. They weren't volatile estrangements. They were drifts, I suppose, and Peter was in Sydney at the time staying away because they'd had some disagreements, and he had felt at the time that it was best if he did stay away, that he couldn't be what she wanted him to be. Mum was up this end feeling exactly the same, that she couldn't be what he wanted or needed either, and that they were both making each other unhappy. So no, he wasn't here.
And Peter's father, Michael, you aware what happened to him? I'm assuming he's long gone, is he?
Yes, he's long gone. He died, I think, 10 or 15 years before my mother. He kept running fish and chip shops. Peter stayed in contact with his father. He always said that, of course, he didn't like his father, but in some child's way, he loved him. His father was all he had, and it's all he knew. So he was in contact with his father, took him to the races occasionally, but was always very aware of his father's capabilities.
Tell me about the tour that Peter, your brother, took you on when you were getting his story.
Oh, the tour of shame and unhappiness around Sydney into some of the places where he'd been on the streets as a child. One in particular, apart from the institutions and the hospitals where he'd suffered so badly, right under the Sydney Harbour Bridge, which I'd always seen as a beautiful aspect and a lovely perspective. There are some shrubs and lovely looking grass there, but this is where Peter spent a great deal of his time sleeping rough with homeless men or alone.
At what age?
Between 10 and 15, on and off. Little boy with a caliper squeezed in, hiding in these bushes and eating scraps that some of the homeless men would give him to eat.
That must have been devastating to hear that.
Oh, completely. I in fact, that day, to make it real, because, of course, the devastation layered on layer became very hard to really take in. So that day I crawled into one of those bushes myself to try to, just really get into Peter's skin. Of course, I couldn't. I didn't have a gammy leg, and I didn't have a crutch, and I didn't have everything, you know, that he had suffered. But it was enough, almost, to make me... It just sent chills through me. There was this beautiful vista, this bridge, this harbour. But there was this sense of fear in that place, and there were creatures crawling about, and there was odd bits of rubbish, and I felt a bit afraid myself, and it was broad daylight. So that really pierced me in a way that I guess has never gone away.
Was the curiosity mutual? Did he want to know what your life had been like?
He did. I don't think he wanted to go perhaps to those to that extent of finding out, because of course it just meant looking in the eye what he'd missed out on. He'd missed out on so much, and we knew that. So we've never, you know, encouraged a lot of detail. But he, you know, Peter's not resentful, and he's not in any way angry about that. In fact, every now and then he'll say to me, "Well, if I'd been here when you did that, you know, I would have been the big brother. I wouldn't have let you do that." And even now, you know, we'll say something. He'll say, "No, I'm not going to let you do that. You know, I'm catching up here."
I find that incredibly touching, I must say. I think that's really beautiful.
It is.
How are things between all the siblings now, your brothers and sisters all together?
They're great. Peter lives in Sydney. The rest of us are a bit spread out as well now. Sharon's in Adelaide. My next younger brother is in Nhulunbuy, and there's two of us in Brisbane with my dad, who's still alive and remarried in another little remarkable story. He remarried on his 80th birthday, 3 or 4 years after my mother died. And Evie, who's a wonderful, wonderful woman, they're still married. We all are in phone contact fairly regularly with each other.
So when you got all the documents together, he had a whole lot of documents, didn't he? And you sort of poured through them together. What did Peter see was the through line of his story? I mean, you saw it kind of through your mother's eyes, but how did Peter see that through line?
When he first got the documents, he called me and said, "Oh, I've got these documents, and, you know, it really shows what happened with the polio. And, you know, why don't you write this story? It's the polio is really, you know, I'd like to bring it to light more." And when he sent me the documents, I looked at them and thought, "Oh, goodness, Peter, yes, it's a shocking, shocking thing, but that's not what defines you. What defines you is being pulled out of your mother's arms." So he thought really polio was where his life began and ended. And in a way, I guess it did, Richard, because before he had polio, there was no mother in that life. And he'd suffered and survived polio on his own. And that was his life. That was what he'd achieved. He'd achieved survival from that disease and from that terrible life that he'd had with his father. So that's what he wanted to talk about. It's almost like having a story in which you're the hero and you've won. But I, of course, knew or felt otherwise and said to him, "What defines you is being pulled out of your mother's arms." I think that's the story we have to write, if we're going to write one at all.
But his story was how he became a good man.
Yes, absolutely.
In spite of all this.
And I think he became a good man in spite of not growing up with our mother.
That's so interesting. I mean, you think a story is... I mean, particularly after having read the book, you know, you think the story is this thing that exists independently, but it doesn't. It doesn't. Yes. It's kind of this through line as we see it. And
it
you
is.
See it one way, and your mother will have seen it another, and Peter, of course, will see it very differently. And they're all completely, I don't know, legitimate, but very real ways of seeing what had happened.
Absolutely, and various. And perhaps as we read the book again and we go over it again, you know, other things will come out in terms of its trajectory.
And what do you think now about that pact your mother and your father made to talk, get it all out and talk about it all and then not talk about it? Looking back, and there's no criticism of them, but do you think that nonetheless is wise?
These days, we wouldn't do it, I don't think. I certainly wouldn't recommend it as a way of surviving with any sense of mental health, any kind of trauma. Of course, at the time, though, that seemed to be what you did. There was a war. No one was talking about the war either. Any of these awful tragedies were being firmly closed down. Looking back, I can see that Australia was just that kind of place. It was a place of complicity around tragedy. It was a place of silences.
Has there been so much?
Absolutely.
I mean, there had been so much after the First World War. Just too many people were killed.
Absolutely. All those men not in the street anymore. All those men not there for girls to marry. And all the children who were being taken at the same time. Because that was the question I had, of course, as I came to the end of the book, was why did no one help? And one of the reasons was that children were being taken wholesale around Australia, not just Indigenous children, That was an enormous, enormous part of it. But the children of the poor, summarily removed from their parents for not having breakfast, you know, the children of unwed mothers, everyone was losing kids.
That's fascinating. Christina, thank you so much for being my guest. This is an extraordinary family story. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
I spoke to Christina Olsen in 2014 after she'd published her book called Boy Lost, a Family Memoir. Chris's new novel, called Shell, is about to be published, and we'll put the details for that on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. There are thousands and thousands of conversations there, literally, for you to listen to whenever you like. And don't forget, you can podcast the program through iTunes or whichever podcasting app you like. And we're on Facebook. We put a link to each day's guest there with extra info and some extra photos if we have them. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.